Afternoon, it's 3 o'clock on Wednesday, the 2nd of May, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on KTOO News Juneau Afternoon. Today we'll talk with Paul Rosenthal and Jocelyn Mitchell about classical concerts offering during this year's Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival. Stacey Polson will be here to highlight upcoming activities at the Nugget Mall. Kathy Calvin, tonight's Juneau World Affairs Council speaker, will talk about Alaska and the United Nations. Lucy Merrill and Sue Belita will be here with details about Saturday's concert by the Celebration Handbell Ringers. We'll also learn about Bigfoot and Other Lost Souls opening this week at Perseverance Theater. Mad Writer's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau Afternoon. The forecast for tonight, rain showers likely, low temperatures around 36 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and high temperatures around 50 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two Oklahoma tribes are in a state of emergency after being locked out of their bank accounts. As KGOU's Kurt Gortney reports, the financial troubles are part of an ongoing leadership dispute.
A June 8th court hearing has been scheduled on an Oklahoma bank's decision to freeze the accounts of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes embroiled in a dispute over leadership. The Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes declared a state of emergency Friday after First Bank and Trust Company in Clinton, Oklahoma, took the action. A spokeswoman for the tribe says numerous programs will be affected and workers' hours will be cut, but casinos operated by the tribes will continue normal schedules. Tribal Governor Janice Prairie Chief Boswell and Leslie Wandry Harjo are quarreling over who is the tribe's lawful governor, with each camp setting up its own administration. First Bank attorney Scott Meacham says the tribe's governor is the authorized signatory on tribal accounts, but the bank doesn't know whose signature it should recognize as legitimate. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gortney in Norman, Oklahoma.
Get Out the Vote efforts are underway to reach young Native Americans. Rock the Vote hit the stage where various bands performed over the weekend at a New Mexico powwow. Janie Parrish is Navajo and works with Rock the Vote.
Well, Rock the Vote's been around for about 20 years now, and the real branding marketing efforts started in the early 90s with a lot of the help with MTV. And the basic premise and the founding of Rock the Vote was really to get young people motivated and more involved in our democracy. And one step for doing that is getting them registered to vote. So we focus on the ages between 18 to 30 years old. Of course, we register everyone, but that's our focus group.
Parrish says this is the first year Rock the Vote, based in Washington, D.C., is reaching out to Indian country. She'll be focusing on working with tribes in Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. Rock the Vote efforts include reaching out to high school and college students and partnering with various organizations. Parrish says they want to reach out to Indian country not just for the upcoming presidential election, but county, state, and other elections as well.
For a lot of Native people, what we found is many of them are very interested in water rights issues, lands rights issues, discrimination issues, things that go on in our day-to-day lives. And we try to link that to say, you know what, you do have a voice. You're a citizen of this town, county, state. And if there's something that's going up for vote, you have a right to talk to your elected officials and your constituent. They listen to you. So we try to tie that in, but also the great responsibility of voting, because for many Native Americans, we didn't get that right till 1948 or later. And so understanding the history of what our grandparents, our parents had to go through in order for us to have this right. And it's a really great responsibility. We want more young people to take advantage of it.
Rock the Vote will be hitting powwows, rodeos, and other events across Indian country to try and fill the gap to get more Native people involved in voting efforts. The Cherokee Nation held a grand opening for its National Prison Museum this week. The museum shows the history of crime and punishment of the Oklahoma tribe, as well as relives infamous Cherokee outlaw stories. The Cherokee Prison was the only penitentiary in Indian Territory from 1875 to 1901. It's the third museum now owned and operated by the tribe. Shawnee by Link Wray, who was born on this day in 1929. He pioneered a distorted electric guitar sound, the power chord technique. Wray was proud of his Shawnee heritage and has several songs named after tribes. He passed away in 2005. Ray was inducted into the Native American Music Hall of Fame and was named one of the top 100 guitarists of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Paul Rosenthal and Jesselyn Rintala here to talk about Juneau Jazz and Classics. Classical concerts, the blues opens up with this Friday with Taj Mahal and goes into country and western and a little bit of swing music with a hot club to Cowtown. And also on Saturday there's a strings at the Shrine. Paul and Jesselyn, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Nice to be here, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Strings at the Shrine, Paul?
Well, the Shrine is just the most wonderful place to play music, as I learned last year. I'm just thrilled to be doing it again. You go out to this beautiful place, and you go into this wonderful building, and the feeling is so intimate and cozy and perfect, and we're going to play the beautiful music of Mozart, and the string quartet that I'm playing with is going to play a Ravel quartet. So it's a perfectly beautiful program, and I am going to go there, and I'm going to sing my heart out. And all those lucky people who come. There isn't room for that many, all those lucky people, but I hope we'll fill it up with all those lucky people who come, and they will have a really nice experience.
And from what I understand, there's still tickets left over, but you better act quick by going to JuneauJazzAndClassics.org. JazzAndClassics.org.
That's right, JazzAndClassics.org. One of the lovely, intimate things about the venue at the Shrine of St. Therese is that it is small and intimate, so we're about 80% sold out on both of our shows, but there are two shows this year, so one's at 4 p.m. and one's at 6:30 this Saturday, so get your tickets now.
And there's a cabaret workshop on Sunday with Barney McClure starting?
Yes. Barney is hosting a four-day cabaret workshop, so calling all singers, that starts on Saturday, actually, is the first meeting. And all of the workshops are at the Jack, so there's a meeting on Saturday, then Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, and everything culminates in a grand performance on Wednesday where all of this amazing local talent that's been working with Barney for 4 days gets to actually be part of the festival this year and be one of our official events and perform for family and friends and neighbors. So that's Wednesday the 9th at the Jack.
And what are the classical offerings you're hearing today?
Ooh, well, Paul, would you like to talk about the other performances that you're taking part in?
Well, there's going to be duets at the Depot. That's the downtown Alaska Brewery Depot. And Linda and I will be playing some music for two violins there, which is, of course, tremendous fun to do. And I don't remember what day is that, Jesselyn.
That is happening on a little ways out from now. That's Wednesday, May 10th, or 16th, rather.
Oh, that really is a ways out.
Yeah, and you'll be joined by Jeffrey Solo, is that right?
Jeff is an old friend of Linda and mine. We knew him from our student days, so that's a while ago. We've played lots of music together since, and we're in constant togetherness with Jeff here, there, and other places.
How extensive is your network of friends?
It's a great thing. You know, they never told me that I was going to have such a network when I went to school, but it really did turn out that way. And the same, I think, maybe Linda did have that understanding about those things when she was in school. But you know, like the old boys club that goes to the Yale Business School or the Harvard Law School or this or that, you know, they know that they're going to be partners and friends for the rest of their lives. And I didn't know that about my fellow students when I was a kid, but it sure has been true. And there's some really wonderful people there among them. Jeff is just a terrific guy, terrific friend over so many years, and I wouldn't be surprised if this isn't the 100th or more concert that we'll play together.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe more. You
know. Who picks out the music?
Well, Linda organizes all that. You know, she is a really good put-together musician. Some musicians are good at playing, some musicians are good at organizing, and Linda's good at all of it. So she puts this stuff together, And in this case, now that I'm not doing my own festival anymore in Sitka, I'm just a go-there-and-fiddle guy, which is kind of nice.
Imagine. Jesslyn, more concerts?
Sure. There's one more that you're performing in, is that right, Paul?
Yes. That's a kind of special one, actually. That will be with Jeffrey again, and a pianist with whom I did a little touring with Jeffrey in Alaska a couple of years ago, Yoni Levyatov. He's a Russian-Israeli, now living in America, pianist. A terrific guy and a really beautiful player and very entertaining. And so the three of us are playing a program of the music of Dmitri Shostakovich, which is, that's an event. He's really, Shostakovich, if you were Russian, you would think he was one of the greatest composers like Mozart and Beethoven. And for those of us who aren't Russian, we think he was a very, very great composer indeed. But maybe he doesn't quite hit that Soviet chord, I know what life is all about, the way he does for the Russians that lived through that dreadful period that he was the chronicler of in music.
What makes it so special for you to play?
It's music that it's a straight shot right to the heart. It's a very, very powerful description of how life is in terrible times. You know, you still have love, you still have laughter, you still have things, but it's also tinged with bitterness and ruthlessness and difficulty. And this music is very expressive of all that stuff. And it really speaks to people, very, very close up and personal. And I like playing it because I enjoy being able to help the impact of the music occur, you know. Just when it sings, it sings of pain and woe and loneliness and terror. And when it's brilliant, it's the kind of brilliance that happens when the air is very uncomfortable for the meteor that's flying through it. You know? It's very great stuff. Don't miss Shostakovich. And when is that happening, by the way?
That is happening at Chapel by the Lake. So that's another lovely setting to do
sure
the Shostakovich performance. Yep. So that's Thursday, May 17th at Chapel by the Lake.
Thank you. And Jeffrey and I have played Shostakovich before, and Yoni and Jeffrey have played it, and this will be the first time that we're playing a very, very expressive and wonderful piano trio that was written actually as a kind of requiem for Shostakovich's dearest friend who died. And even death is spoken of in a kind of frightening and frightful and expressive way that you don't want to miss it. You really don't.
And what are the classical events we have going on?
Wow, there's one more I want to mention, Jeff. Exactly. So I'll do the basic introduction, which is we're calling the program Mad About Beethoven, and last year we did a different all Beethoven program, Bravo Beethoven, which was such a great success that we are doing another Beethoven program this year, and that will again be at the Holy Trinity Church, and that's coming up Thursday, May 10, so a week from tomorrow at 7:30. And that's, in fact, sponsored by KRNN.
And if you need tickets, how do you get them?
Tickets are always online, 24 hours a day, at jazzandclassics.org. You can also give us a call, 463-3378.
And otherwise, we'll see you at Taj Mahal.
Taj Mahal. We are so excited for Taj on Friday. Folks, if you didn't get your tickets yet, come by at 7 o'clock. We're going to start a wait list to get all the people in to see Taj Mahal as we possibly can. So come at 7 sharp and get your name on the list, unless you started early and got your tickets when they went on sale back in February, March, or April, because they're all gone now.
And the Hot Club of Cowtown is performing Sunday night at 7:30 at the Hope Hall.
You have that nail on the head, Jeff. That's exactly right. So Sunday night for Hot Club of Cowtown. They will also be doing a free performance the next day at noon at the State Office Building. But that Sunday night show promises to be a great packed dance party at Hope Hall.
JazzandClassics.org is a place to go for tickets and a lot of more information that you need to get to find out all about this Jazz and Classics Festival. Jesslyn and Paul, thank you for going down to the station. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Only that I look forward to seeing you and lots of other friends there at the concerts.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 2nd of May, 2012. It was on this date, 1536, Anne Boleyn, the second wife of King Henry VIII, was arrested for high treason, adultery, and incest. She was intelligent, outspoken, she'd been raised in France, she had educated opinions about politics and religious reform, She came to the court when she was 20 years old to serve as lady-in-waiting. She soon caught the eye of the king, and for 7 years he courted her, and for 7 years she put him off. He managed to get his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled by breaking with the Pope, declaring himself head of the Church of England. And then Anne Boleyn consented to marry him. Their early months of marriage were happy ones. Their first child, a girl born in 1533, Elizabeth. Anne had several miscarriages after that, and she never gave Henry the son that he so desperately wanted. So he accused her of every capital offense he could think of, affairs and incest with her brother and plotting his murder and witchcraft, and she was convicted and sentenced to death, beheaded by sword. In her last letter to Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn wrote, "Your Grace's displeasure and my imprisonment are things so strange to me that what to write I am altogether ignorant. Never a prince had a wife more loyal in all duty and in all true affection than you have ever found in Anne Boleyn. But if you have already determined of me, and that not only my death but an infamous slander, then I desire of God that he will pardon your great sin herein, and likewise my enemies, and that he will not call you to account for your unprincely and cruel usage of me at his general judgment seat, where both you and myself must shortly appear." It's the birthday of Dr. Benjamin Spock, born in New Haven, 1903, author of the Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, which came out in 1946, which began, "You know more than you think you do." It was the parenting Bible for the post-war moms and dads raising the baby boomer generation. It's the birthday of Jerome K. Jerome, born in Walsall, England, 1859. It was he who said, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours." And it was on this day, 1885, Good Housekeeping Magazine went on sale, offering housekeeping tips, parenting advice, product reviews, and fiction. The Good Housekeeping Experiment Station tested and evaluated consumer goods, and products that passed were given the Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval, which became part of the language. Here's a poem for today by Howard Moss, entitled "Making a Bed." I know how to make a bed while still lying in it, and slip out of an imaginary hole as if I were squeezed out of a tube. Tug, smooth, the bed is made. And if resurrections are this easy, why then I believe in all of them. Lazarus rising from his tomb, Elijah at the vertical. Though death, I think, has more than clever household hints in mind, and wants the bed made once and for good. Making a Bed by Howard Moss, from his new selected poems, published by Athenaeum and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by CenturyLink, linking Americans and Fortune 500 companies to what matters most. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. Edited by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:19 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. Here, our next guest on the Juneau afternoon is Stacey Polson, here to talk about activities going on at the Nugget Mall. Stacey, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me.
So it starts every day, I guess, at the Nugget Mall.
Oh, we have, yeah. Lots of events going on in May.
It's coming up on this May 5th. Is going to be the Abate event?
Uh-huh. It's a motorcycle awareness event put on by Abate. They're going to have live music, motorcycle, rodeo, food, and actually they'll have bikes for sale, two motorcycles for sale. That is from 11 until 2 on Saturday.
And you got events coming up, it seems like, every weekend on the end of the mall.
Yeah, in May we definitely have events every weekend. On May 12th, Bartlett Hospital will be there offering a free glucose and cholesterol screening from 10 a.m. until 1:30. And Parks and Rec will also be there from 10 until 2 for their summer sports signups. Then on May 18th, we have the Juno Jazz and Classics Brown Bag Concert that starts at noon. It's going to be cello and piano. And then on May 19th and 20th, we're going to combine our regular used boat show with an outdoor gear sale. So you can reserve a booth, bring in your used fishing, camping, skiing gear. We have registration forms available at the mall office already. So that'll be May 19th and 20th. And then May 26th and 27th, we're going to be having an arts, crafts, and antiques show. And those are always fantastic. Lots of homemade, unique gifts and fun stuff, just fun. May 26th, we're going to have a springtime English tea party from 11 until 1:30. And this is going to be a fundraising event that Vintage Fair Cafe is putting on. They're going to be offering crustless sandwiches, scones with lavender cream and lemon curd. And it's just fun, and it's very nice. They set up tables with linen and tea, china. So it's fun. That's about it. We're going to have our Father's Day miniature golf in June. If you have any questions or need more information about any of those events, it's posted on our website at nuggetmalljuno.com, or you can give me a call, 789-4439.
It's Stacey Poulsen from the Nugget Mall. Thank you for coming down. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I hope not. Just give me a call if there is. Thank you for having me.
It's a little bit of music from the California Honey Drops, some of the featured artists at the Juno Jazz and Classics Festival this year. California Honey Drop, some of the featured artists at the Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival. If you need more information on them or their groups are appearing, go to jazzandclassics.org. In the studio with us now is Kathy Calvin, General World of the Juneau World Affairs Council, speaker for tonight, and along with Jim Clark from the Juneau World Affairs Council. Jim and Kathy, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Jeff, thanks for having us. We're the Juneau World Affairs Council, as you know, is a nonprofit, free admission for all of our events. And tonight we're very, very fortunate to have Kathy Calvin, who is the CEO of the UN Foundation, which supports UN efforts. And I'll let her explain what she does in that role.
Great. Well, thanks, Jim. I'm so happy to be here. It's a real privilege. And Jeff, great to be on your show. I've heard a lot about you from other Junoites that I've been seeing since I've been here. And first, let me just say how great it is to be in Juneau. I've never been in Alaska before, so this has been a really exciting trip already. I've seen both museums, been shopping, have been out to the Mendenhall Glacier, seen the shrine. So in a day and a half, I feel like I'm getting to know Juneau and see why everybody wants to stay once they've come to visit. So thanks. So tonight I'm excited. I'm going to have a chance to talk at the World Affairs Council, and Jim was kind enough to invite me to come down on Friday. I'll be in Anchorage speaking at the World Affairs Council there, talking about why the UN is valuable and in the U.S. strategic interests and why it's even more strategic to Alaska than maybe many Alaskans know. Our job is to support the UN, and we do that in the three ways. We build partnerships, public-private partnerships for UN issues. We support the UN's lobbying in the United States, and we make it easy for all Americans to learn more and help the UN do the good work that it does all over the world.
Now, in 2001, Newsweek named you one of the 150 women who shake the world. Who initially shook your world? I guess people ask you that all the time.
No, nobody's ever asked me that. My husband shakes my world now, but originally I had a mother who was really inspiring to me, and she and my dad both said I could do anything I wanted. And, you know, I never thought I would be in a position to work for an organization like the UN that does work all around the world and is, you know, the premier multilateral institution, but I feel really good that I have a chance to help translate its work to average Americans like myself, you know, who wouldn't normally think about the UN in their daily work, but probably are touched and affected by it.
You spent the bulk of your professional life in the media or trying to influence. What do you consider to be the media's responsibility in the mix?
Oh, boy, the media is so critical, and I feel like the media has been letting us down lately. You know, so many newspapers and television and radio stations have had to cut back on their international coverage, and so we aren't covering the things that are happening around the world that affect us all. Second, I think sometimes the media has gotten to be biased that they try to show no bias by showing both sides of issues when, in fact, there aren't two sides. You know, there's not two sides on global warming. We know what the issues are, for instance. And finally, I think the media has got to catch up with the newest revolution, which is that people themselves have a lot to say and are trying to share their voice and create their own publishing through the internet. And the media needs to acknowledge that that's a very real response to the fact that people feel they weren't getting all the information they need. Public radio does obviously a really good job of that, but we need to do better.
Alaska and the UN, more connected than you know, is the title of your speech tonight before the World Affairs Council downstairs at 5 o'clock at the KTUO TV studios. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Well, I'm going to talk about some ways that the UN affects all of our lives, whether it's in saving Americans from having to go overseas in the most dangerous places in the world. The UN sends peacekeepers so that we don't have to send our own. The UN is deeply involved in a lot of commercial interests, such as fisheries. The Law of the Sea is a very important UN treaty that's currently stalled in Congress, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about how the UN Foundation itself runs major campaigns to help people get engaged in helping girls around the world stay in school and delay marriage, that helps prevent and end childhood diseases like polio and measles and malaria.
When did the United Nations start forming, and when did Alaska first appear on its radar?
That's a good question. So the UN was started in 1945. And, you know, it's an American creation. It was founded in San Francisco. It was the last thing that Franklin Roosevelt was working on before he died. And then Harry Truman said, this is so important, I'm going to make it happen. That was obviously before Alaska became a state. And, you know, I think the vision at that time was to prevent any more world wars. That was such a horrible time, and everyone knew that we needed an institution that gave a vehicle for, for peace to be worked out as opposed to being worked out on the battlefield. And I think it's been incredibly successful in that realm. We do have some fights and some issues, but they get worked out in the UN, where there's an opportunity for every country, all 192 member nations, to have a say.
And when did Alaska first appear on its radar?
When did Alaska first appear on the UN's radar?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. It probably has been most recently on its radar with the Law of the Sea discussions. The Law of the Sea Treaty was passed by a number of nations during a UN negotiation maybe 10 or so years ago. The U.S. still has not negotiated or has not signed it. And so that's one of the ways that I think Alaska has been on the UN's radar. Another way is certainly that the relationship between Alaska and the whole Pacific area is one that the UN is mindful of. The UN and the U.S. both are looking very much toward the Pacific now as opposed to toward the Atlantic in their thinking about world issues.
What are some of the major issues facing the UN these days?
I'd say there's about four. One of the most important ones that the Secretary General has identified is ensuring that women and girls have healthier and safer lives. He has a major initiative to reduce childhood and maternal mortality. Second is ensuring that the world has access to energy, universal access to energy. And this is another place where Alaska is critical, obviously as a major oil and gas producer, but it's looking at making sure that the whole world, 2 billion people who currently do not even have access to electricity, will have electricity and access to safe, renewable, clean energy. Third, the UN is very focused on some of the trouble spots in the Middle East. The Arab Awakening that took place last year was supported by the UN, and it's got its pulse on places like Syria right now, and making sure that Egypt is having a chance to have a safe and free election coming up. And finally, human rights, which are so critical to all of us. The U.S. just rejoined the UN's Human Rights Council, is running for re-election this year, and that's another place where I think a lot of our global interests are being served by the UN.
Any thoughts on the recent Chinese blind demonstrator?
The blind fellow who just came out. Yeah, that's a very serious issue. So the Secretary General has spoken out about that issue and has talked about the importance of human rights. He's been very strong on human rights, whether it's with Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar, or what's happening in Beijing, or what happened in the Middle East this year. I think we have in Ban Ki-moon, he's a Korean who's just entered his second term as Secretary General, somebody who really is not afraid to stand up for those issues.
I've been talking with Kathy Calvin, who will be speaking in front of the Juno World Affairs Council tonight at 5 o'clock in the KTUO TV studios. The talk is free and open to the public. Kathy, do you have anything you might want to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, I'm really glad to be here. I think the questions you're asking are so important. It's not necessary that all Americans wake up and think about the UN every day. Junoites have lots to think about. But we do know, we just released a poll. We do polling about the United Nations every 6 months, and we find that more than 80% feel that the UN is in U.S. strategic interest. It's important that the UN stay engaged and pay our dues. And third, that the U.S. is active in some of the most important UN agencies like the World Health Organization that look after all of our needs and interests. So I'm glad to be here and have a chance to talk about that with people tonight.
Kathy Calvin, thank you for coming by 5 o'clock in the KTVO TV studios. Jim, thank you for coming down as well.
Thank you, Jeff.
part of our song. I'll do the call, and you can answer me. It goes like this. One world.
LaFond, the time is 3:37, and you are tuned in to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest here to talk about the Celebration Handbell Ringers concert this Saturday at 7 o'clock at Resurrection Lutheran Church. Lucy Marilyn Supalita, thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you very much for having us.
So, Lucy, the history of the handbells, please, in a few minutes here.
The history of the handbells.
In a nutshell.
Actually, the handbells were first developed as a training exercise for people that were ringing the big tower bells in England and Europe. And they would, because they didn't want to practice so the whole countryside could hear their mistakes, they made originally just wooden bells, and they'd gather in the local pub and practice their change ringing. So they figured out the choreography of who played when, and then they actually made small pitched bells and practiced that way. And that's how they got started. And they were brought to the United States during the 30s with one of the big entrepreneurs during the
P.T. Barnum, maybe?
Yeah, P.T. Barnum, that's what I'm thinking of, yeah. And
there's a ringer born every minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my job.
Yeah, oh, sorry.
anyway, so that's how it started. And it started out in churches, and I'd say most bell choirs are still in churches, but a lot of communities have them now, and it's getting more in schools and community things. So it's really spreading, and it's grown a lot in even like the last 10 years. There's always new techniques, new, much more complicated music, more octaves. We have 5 octaves of bells. Some of the big choirs now have 7 octaves of bells, and it's pretty amazing how it's grown so fast.
And you brought a couple of bells with you to demonstrate?
I did bring a couple of bells. I brought our lowest C and our highest C. And I have to say, I wish this was on TV so you could see this beautiful big bell. But it's so heavy for me that I have to hold it with 2 hands and make a very concerted effort to ring, which I will try to do. Oops. If you hold it the right way, it works a bit. So that takes a lot of work for me to ring, but one of our ringers, a woman, Karen Laufer, plays down the bass, and she has one of these bells in each hand, and she's ringing them back and forth and over her head, and it's pretty amazing.
It's about the size of a fish bucket.
they're big and they're heavy.
And you also have ones hopefully a little bit smaller?
Yes. So in addition to the bells, we also have choir chimes, and this is the lowest choir chime that we have.
And then the highest one is.
And these are like tuning forks out of aluminum square with a clapper on the outside. And we play those with the bells to get a different contrast and sound.
How many members of the handbell ringers are there?
There's 11 ringers, and I keep them very busy.
And how many bells do they play?
There's 61 bells and 37 chimes.
Are they hard to play?
I'll answer that.
Okay.
Because I'm a member of the bell choir. As the director, she just gets to coordinate everything. And the interesting thing about a bell choir, it's different than an orchestra or a band or a voice choir, because you just play your notes. And so you don't really play a melody line. You don't play, you know, when you come in, you are part of a whole line. And so you have to just play your notes. So it's a very different musical experience. They're not necessarily hard to play. It's just, it takes a lot of concentration so that you know where you fit in the overall piece of music.
So some of the people in the middle of the choir have two bells like D and E plus the sharps or flats that are associated with them. But the little bells up on the top, they have their two bells plus the octave higher and the sharps and flats associated with those. So they may have eight bells that they're playing. And then the bass can play eight bells too. So it's kind of a choreography issue. You're trying to figure out which bell you're playing with which hand, and then if you're picking up an accidental or a mallet or some of the other pieces of equipment, it's challenging but fun.
You mentioned a mallet and other pieces of equipment. What does that mean?
Well, sometimes when we're playing, we have mallets that we play the bells with. Sometimes we play the bells while they're on the table, like a xylophone. Sometimes we play them with mallets while they're held in the air, which gives kind of an ethereal kind of effect. And there's different hardnesses of mallets for the different sizes of bells. So you have to make sure you have the right mallet. And if you're playing two octaves, you might be having to have two mallets in your hand to play the right one. And then sometimes you're playing bells with one hand and chimes with the other. So it gets pretty complicated.
How long have you been working with bells?
Boy, I don't know. I think it's about 25 years. It's well over 20, I know.
Some notable composers for bell music?
There are. I don't know if anybody would recognize their names. Cynthia Dobrinsky, our favorite lately, is Kathy Mucklebust. She was here last year and came and did a workshop with us, and she's a great composer. There's lots of new composers coming on all the time with bells to learn new sounds that you can get with them.
And your job as conductor is to point at the person and ring the appropriate bell at the appropriate time?
Mostly I do it when they don't do it appropriately.
Yeah, if Lucy points at you, you know you've done something. And that could be something right, or it could be something like, were you intending to do that? Because that's not exactly what the music intended to do.
So it seems like you have to psych yourself into performing handbells.
Do you know, it is a lovely thing, and I have been both a performer in the handbell choir and someone who listens to it, and it takes a lot of work for it to come together, but when it comes together, it is an extraordinarily profound experience, meditative, joyful. It just adds so many textures to a musical experience. It is really quite astonishing.
One of the things about handbells, it's very visual. So when you go to a concert, you can see the scale move down the table or up the table. You can see the bass using mallets and the treble using something else. And so you
can
kind
of holding four bells at once,
yeah,
and shaking them and doing this whole variety of things.
It's quite interesting to watch. We had one concert where we had the low bells playing. They were plucking their bells, and I had someone ask me afterwards, "Well, where were the cellos?" So it has really quite a range of sounds that you can produce. One of the newest techniques that we're using is called the singing bell, and that's like when you put a finger around the lip of a crystal goblet, you can make it sing. Well, we can do that with bells, too, only we use a wooden dowel and run it around the outside of the bell.
You must go through a heck of a lot of brasso.
Actually, they're not brass. They're bronze, and we do polish them every year, take them all apart, take the handles off, take the clappers out. And even though we wipe them down after every rehearsal, it's amazing what gunk gets inside.
I'm talking to Lucy Merrill and Sue Belita about the Celebration Handbell Ringers concert this Saturday at 7 o'clock at Resurrection Lutheran Church. How can people get tickets?
There are no tickets. This is a donation concert, so come, and maybe the Spirit will move you to be really generous. The money is going to be used for the ministries of the church. Mostly our primary one is to the chaplaincy program at the jail, but we're also doing a remodeling project for the church that's going to provide more space for the quilters and our food bank. So that's where the money is going to go.
And it all starts at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. Mm-hmm.
And I would just like to lift up, we're very particularly fundraising for the Lemon Creek Chaplaincy Program. Once a year at Christmas time, our bell choir goes to Lemon Creek to play for the inmates. And we usually distribute the chimes so that they can play along with some of it. And it is an astonishing, you watch these people who have been kind of maybe bored or not really overly engaged by watching us. The minute they are allowed to hold a chime and make the music and participate in it, it really matters. It really opens them up. And so this is a combination of acknowledging the fact that a lot of people use Resurrection Lutheran Church as a practice venue or as a meeting place. And so this is a way of supporting both the mission that we do, a very particular mission that we do, and the overall building use, community building use.
In addition to the bells, we have some other groups that are going to be performing. Mike Truax is going to sing. Judy Mitchell and Annie Hagelberg are going to be playing piano solos, and the ensemble from the Pride Chorus are going to be singing with us, so there's going to be lots to see and hear.
And I'll start this Saturday at 7 o'clock at Resurrection Lutheran Church, which is the corner of 10th and Glacier.
That's correct.
Anything you'd like to add, I forgot to ask?
Oh, it just come. It's going to be fun, and it's fun to watch and fun to listen to.
JDHS is putting on a hilarious play about Southern friends who convert an abandoned church into a day spa to add some spice back into their lives.
Come laugh till you cry at the Hallelujah Girls May 3rd, 4th, 11th, and 12th at 7 p.m. at the JDHS Auditorium.
Tickets at Hearthside Books, thejack.org, or at the door.
Proceeds will go to help this award-winning theater department perform at the 2013 International Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland.
So come on out, y'all, and support these fine, talented youngins.
Time is 3:51, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a June afternoon. Next guest is Elizabeth Lucas, director of Bigfoot and Other Lost Souls, and artistic director of Perseverance Theater at Roach. We're going to talk about their last play of the season, Bigfoot and Other Lost Souls. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
So Bigfoot and Other Lost Souls, that sounds like a great title of a little play. It should be a great play.
It's a winner of a title, that's for sure, yeah.
Music and lyrics by Mark Coleman and book by Adrian Royce and the plot. Can you describe the plot, please, Elizabeth?
Sure. It's about a woman who gets hired to direct a documentary about Bigfoot, and she goes into the woods and meets all sorts of intense characters and ultimately decides the truth about Bigfoot by the end, while learning a lot about herself along the way.
Would it be a stretch to call this a comedy?
Not at all. It would be a black comedy, I would say, but it's definitely on the zany side.
What kind of special considerations do you have when directing a play about a near-mythical, iconic figure?
Well, you know, in many ways, it's much more about the person. This piece is sort of semi-autobiographical. The writer actually was hired to do a documentary about Bigfoot, and she took a number of characters from her life and put them together into this story. So it's more about her and her sort of spirit quest on this ride than it is about specifically Bigfoot.
Plus, it's a musical.
Yes, it is. Songs are by Mark Holman, who wrote the Broadway hit You're in Town, and he's coming out to see it tonight.
Elizabeth Lucas, you're directing the play. A little bit about your background, please.
Sure. I'm from Indiana originally. I live in New York now. I direct movies and musicals. I'm one of the founders of the New York Musical Theater Festival and have done a lot of new work, and that's new musicals are my main focus these days.
And the band is in the basement.
They are, yes. It's a very detailed and large orchestration. I think much larger than you might normally get, really on any level. So with all the large instruments, we needed to give them some space.
Aren't you the artistic director of the theater? What'd you pick Bigfoot?
Well, Mark sent me a draft of the script quite a while ago, and it was a very different story at the time, but there were some great demo recordings with it, too. And I think, as Elizabeth said, the heroine, her name is Bernie Bernstein, the documentary film writer, is a character that I have never seen lead a musical before, and that was really intriguing. Mark's music is great, so if you love music, he's just a really terrific composer. And then there was something, the way Mark, he's been here before, this is his second project with us, but the way he put it in his letter back then was, do you think Alaskans would be interested in this story about Bigfoot? I mean, how cool would that be? And as I started to read them, the other lost souls of the title of the play are really, it's kind of an eclectic group of, I don't know what, quite want to say misfits, because I think some of them are a really good fit for the lives that they've chosen to lead, but they're oddball and offbeat characters, and I think we know who those kinds of people are really well because we've chosen to live here.
Both can speak on this, but it must be an art reading a script and imagining it sitting on stage.
Some are harder than others. This one is definitely one of the more difficult, as is anything that is physical comedy. In many cases, it's very hard to read on the page. But once this comes alive, there's so many opportunities for comedy and for exploring these characters that sort of leap to life once it's off the page.
And the actors are?
Well, Bernie Bernstein is Rachel Landon, just a fantastic part for Rachel.
And she's been here before, yes?
And she has performed for us before. She was in East Nation, for example. Enrique Bravo plays Rudy Guevara. I think that's what you need to know about Rudy, is his name is Rudy Guevara. Eric Cover, who's new to us, he's from Anchorage, plays Nikolai Stevenson, the Bigfoot and bear tracker. And Patricia Hull plays his wife, Maggie Stevenson, the loyal wife. She's great in this. Keith McCoy, who people saw in Raisin in the Sun, he played Walter Lee Younger, is playing a very different character named Maximum Gray, who's an artist and a friend of Bernie Bernstein's. Ryan Curley, who's a newcomer to us, lives here in town, is playing Donnie McGregor. And Erica Rothschild is playing Ursula McGregor. Erica's been with us for a long time, but this is her main stage debut. Allison Holtkamp is playing Sheriff Martha, the sheriff of Mount Shasta County. Jerry Demert is playing Brian, an FBI agent, and Salisa Thole is playing his sidekick. And then Rick Seeley, who has been working with us behind the scenes for a long time, is playing Jesse James, Sheriff Martha's dog.
And the musicians?
I want to mention Stephen Gross, who is did the arrangements and is the music supervisor and worked with Mark, brought him in on this, who's been fantastic. He's been working with Rob Cohen, who is our musical director. And then the band is... Tyree Peeney on cello, Walker Janelle on percussion, Todd Hunt, who's going to be handing it off to what is Hope's last name? To another reed player. Todd is playing reeds, and then a guitarist who we brought in named Justin. I don't have Justin's last name either, but a really wonderful guitarist who's playing acoustic, electric, and a little bit of banjo. So five pieces, but they play a lot of instruments. It's really rich orchestration.
And how do they communicate with the actors on stage?
Betsy Sims is a genius and has worked just with some great gear. There's the audio monitors, of course, and video monitors, and it's pretty amazing. So they have the room to play and spread out down there, and then it sounds great in the room, too.
This was quite a debate when we were designing the set because they needed the space, and the musical values of this were incredibly important to the writers and I think to Art as well. And so we really debated, and in order to not in any way decrease this orchestration, we had to let them have their space.
Yeah, we felt it was really important for the composer and the orchestrator to realize their vision and that the music really drives the production. But we needed some room for Bernie and her characters to act and dance. So that was our challenge with this.
Are there designers in the crew?
The set designer is Akiko Roach. The costume designer is Christina Rummery, who's making her debut with us. She's a kind of a wacky and terrific colleague of Akiko's and mine from NYU. The lighting designer is me, and Rory Stitt is here doing the sound.
It opens up this Friday at Perseverance Theater at 7:30 in the evening.
It does, and then it runs through May 27th, Sunday the 27th. We close on a 2 o'clock matinee with performances Thursday through Sundays. Tickets are at perseverancetheater.org, and then the usual outlets, Hearthside Books, The Jack, jhc.org, or by calling 463-TIXS.
Elizabeth Lucas and Laura Roach, thank you for coming by the station today and talking about Bigfoot and other lost souls.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
The KTOO KRNN live radio auction is coming up May 12th. Tune into either station or come on by the studio to bid on more than 200 items, including a trip to Mexico, local kayak trips, handmade jewelry, glacier flight tours, fresh baked goodies, local theater tickets, and so much more. We're putting the finishing touches on the catalog now, but it will be posted on our websites by Monday. Pre-bids are welcome and encouraged. Again, that's the KTOO KRNN live radio auction coming up on May 12th.
Some music from the Hot Club of Cowtown. They'll be appearing Sunday night at the Hope Hall. That's the former A&B Hall at 7:30 in the evening. And that's brought to you by the Juno Jazz and Classics folks. You're tuned in to KTOO in Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valinok Bay area, tune to K276AF at 103.1. Lemon and Swatcha Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM at 88.1. K220BT Sersuna at 91.9. An excursion into the Nicey Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210AS 89.9, also live online at www.ktoo.org. For the forecast for tonight, looks like rain showers, low temperatures around 38 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers. Forecast for Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain showers. And forecast for Friday, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 48 degrees. Thank you for tuning in for Juno Afternoon today. Have a great evening and a pleasant week.